Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
The February wind was driving waves in over the Promenade des Anglais, and the rain was falling with an intensity that even Connemara would envy. So I abandoned my plan to explore the old part of Nice and instead boarded a number 15 bus and headed north, out of the city, into the suburb of Simier to visit the Marc Chagall Museum. Approaching the museum in a slightly roundabout way, as I did, because I managed to get lost, the visitor is prepared for the otherworldly nature of Chagall's paintings by the unfamiliar sight, at least to an Irishman, of orange trees laden with fruit in neighbouring gardens in spite of the February chill. Once in the museum, you're struck by how his paintings emanate a sort of quiet tenderness, despite the fact that Chagall, a Russian Jew, was for many years a displaced refugee. Seemingly forever on the move from Russia to France, from Paris to Nice, from Nice to New York, for some time just one step ahead of the Nazis, there is no sense of the persecution or fear that must have haunted him. Instead, intertwined couples float serenely on backgrounds of vibrant blue. Strange fish-like creatures move around the edges of the canvas. Donkeys blow trumpets just for the hell of it, as if to say life is for celebrating. Even the painting entitled The Sacrifice of Isaac manages to make Isaac look relatively unconcerned at his imminent death, while Abraham, wielding a knife, looks to heaven for guidance. But relax, the painting seems to say, an angel is about to intervene. Isaac will be liberated by the angel. All will be well. Chagall knew what it was to have an angel intervene in his life. His angel was the splendidly named Hiram Bingham IV, known to all as Harry, without whom there might not be a Chagall Museum in Nice or anywhere else. His father, Hiram Bingham III, considered by many to be the inspiration for Indiana Jones, combined the careers of serious academic, dashing adventurer, and amateur archaeologist. Harry Bingham led a much less public but arguably more important life, because he saved the lives of approximately 2,500 Jews. After graduating from Harvard, Bingham joined the Foreign Service and was posted to the American consulate in Marseille in 1937. By 1940, Marseille had become a centre for refugees hoping to escape to the US from Europe. Official US policy, however, regarding refugees was unwelcoming, to say the least. Breckinridge Long, the Assistant Secretary of State, wrote in July 1940, "We can effectively stop the number of immigrants into the United States by simply advising our consuls to put every obstacle in the way and to postpone and postpone and postpone the granting of the visas." Bingham rapidly became disenchanted with this policy and mounted a one-man campaign from within the Foreign Office to help refugees. Over a period of 10 months, he produced false travel documents, sheltered people in his own home, and helped thousands to flee from France, among them Marc Chagall, who had been arrested by Marseille police after a roundup of Jews. Eventually, the displeasure of his superiors at such blatant flouting of official policy made itself felt. In April 1941, Bingham was posted to Lisbon. An official document noted, "This transfer not made at his request, nor for his convenience." 6 months later, he was again relocated, this time to Buenos Aires. After the war, Bingham was repeatedly passed over for promotion. Finally accepting that his career in the Foreign Service was effectively over, he resigned and spent the remainder of his life running a farm in Connecticut. He struggled financially and was forced to accept handouts from his colourful father. He never really spoke to his 11 children in detail about his wartime activities. It was only after his death in 1988, when his son discovered documents relating to his time in Marseille hidden in the house, that the family began to have a clearer understanding of their father's heroism. They mounted a campaign to have his work acknowledged. In 2002, Secretary of State Colin Powell honoured him with a posthumous Constructive Dissent Award, saying that Bingham had risked his life and his career to help over 2,500 Jews and others who were on Nazi death lists to leave France for America. He added, "Harry was prepared to take that risk to his career, to do that which he knew was right." In 2006, a commemorative stamp was issued in his honour. But perhaps the most moving tribute he received was from one of the refugees he helped out of Marseille. An Austrian who found refuge in California, thanks to travel documents supplied by Harry, recalled in an interview, "Bingham," he said, "looked like an angel, only without wings, the angel of liberation."
Church of Ireland people make a great sponge cake, my granny used to say, standing more often than not over her mixing bowl, knuckle deep in brown flour and buttermilk. And now that I've married into that community, a look at my post-Christmas waistline would seem to confirm the accuracy of her statement. Any attempt on my part to avoid sugar in late December was foiled by my in-laws, who made sure I was weighed down with enough pastries and other baked goods to sink the Dublin Bay boy. It's difficult to know where this particular stereotype developed, but it might be attributed in part to the Irish Country Women's Association, the pre-runner of which was founded by a group of mainly Protestant women in Wexford over 100 years ago. Inspired in part by the cooperative movement, which returned a sense of self-reliance and optimism to the countryside, its founder Anita Lett envisioned an association that allowed women bring, as she put it, the full force of their influence on building up the future of Ireland. That the ICA played an important role in the evolution of the state, and in particular the empowerment of women in rural Ireland, was often overlooked because, for good or ill, it became for a time overwhelmingly associated with craft making and baking. Indeed, mention it to most young people, wrote the historian Dermot Ferreter in his history of the organisation, and they'll give a mischievous and slightly disdainful grin and go on to talk about buns and tea cosies. That might have been a problem for my grandmother, who flirted on the fringes of the ICA but never joined, as far as I can tell. That seems a shame, as she embodied the spirit of self-reliance and perseverance which the organisation looked to stir up from the start. She was a sort of Bear Grylls of the cooking world, turning anything within 50 metres of the house into something to put on the dresser. No raspberry was safe from a jam jar, or apple from another tart, which invariably ended up in our car boot when we visited, along with all the vegetables and fruit Grandad had grown too much of, again. But there was never a sponge cake, not in her house or ours, where my own mother turns out enough tea brack and brown bread to feed a scout troop. Even today, there isn't a christening or family gathering where people don't ask for my mother, Colleen's, chocolate cake. Here I must add a disclaimer. The recipe was actually Ursula Grennan's from next door. In fact, it still says Ursula's chocolate cake in Mam's little book of recipes. The elusive sponge did not appear in my life or on my table until many years later, when, dallying in a bar in Addis Ababa, I got talking to a girl who happened to be a member of that group much maligned as home bakers and experts in the way of mixing eggs, white flour and sugar. Some time later, on first visiting her home in the Midlands, I was presented with nothing less than a glorious sponge cake filled with thick cream and stuffed with strawberries. It's usually difficult to put a date on when you know you have been truly welcomed into a family. But the day her mother let me into the secret that she put the eggs on the radiator and this is what made her sponge cake so fluffy, I knew that I'd been accepted, like the ingredients, into the fold. In order to make something that kept for a week in advance, we opted for biscuit cake for our wedding. But in a nod to culinary ecumenism, her side made the filling and mine the icing, mixed in the same yellow stone bowl that Granny needed dough in Kinnity all those years before.
me and Annie walking out into the dusk after choir practice. The ice pop orange lights along the driveway, coming on one by one. The sound of tyres first, skimming across the tarmac and then skidding to a stop in a show-offy way. Jared Sullivan and Mossy McCabe, with others I don't know, they begin to circle us. The vinegary scent of chips mingles with the scent of candle wax and incense on my coat, my Christmas coat, and my new boots clinging to my calves. "Hey, boots," Mossy calls out, skids to a stop in front of me. "Do you want a chip?" The left side of his face is in shadow, so I can't see the twist in that eye. Annie says that it's a glass eye, but I don't think so. Astigmatism, the optician called it, said I had a slight astigmatism in my left eye, but is not as pronounced as his. The chip bag is warm, the last of the chips soggy down the end of the bag. The acidy vinegar shoots up my nose. Jared is offering a neater looking bag of chips to Annie. Jared was my first boyfriend. Came to my house when we were only 11 with a present, a chain with a small cross studded with blue glass. "He's nice, Jared, a good boy. Not like Mossy, who's walking beside me now, stopping to lean the bike against his thigh so he can wolf down the last of the chips." Mossy's brother Fran has been in prison, and his mother drinks. The others fade back into the dusk. Jared and Mossy cycle slowly along with us through the lanes and roads of our housing estate. Annie gets onto the crossbar of Jared's bike and they wave as they take the turn for her house. Her family are what my dad calls holier than thou, and her mother says that my skirts are too short. Annie wears dresses her mother made, and I thought that she would never get a boyfriend. But her eyes are such a deep blue and her eyelashes are spider leg long. Of course Jared likes her. I'm alone in the dark with Mossy, and he's walking me home. And there is no one home, because our shop opens late on a Thursday, and my little sister Ellie goes there after school. "I'll see you then," I say at our side wall in the lane. But he drops his bike and hops over the wall with me, walking me around the back where it's very dark. I wonder if he's going to try and ravish me with hard and insistent lips like the men in my mother's novels. "Good night then," I say as I jump through our unlocked back door into the kitchen. The super sir gives a familiar rattle. He jams his foot in the door like a pushy salesman, grabs my hand and pulls me back outside. His lips on mine are soft, not hard at all. His army jacket smells of vinegary chips. He pulls away a little and looks at me, not smiling. And taller than I thought. He reaches into his jacket pocket and takes out a small box of chocolates. "A present for you." Then he's gone. Coming in from school the next day, Dad comes through the kitchen followed by Mam. "Who's Mossy McCabe?" "Just a friend of Jared's." "Well, his mother was here earlier," Dad says, and he's smiling to himself. Mam joins in, standing at the front door in her fur coat, ranting and raving. "Why?" "Said her son is a little tyke and we should keep you away from him." "I don't know him very well." "Well, maybe stay clear of him all the same," Dad says. Our scruffy poodle Dixie follows me up to my box room bedroom and leaps onto the bed. I lift the crinkly sheet to expose the chocolates, each in its own shaped nest. Next day I pass his gang on the street. Jared breaks away from the others, tells me that Mossy's mother has locked him up, that he had a split lip when he called out from his bedroom window. Nights I lie awake thinking of him, the way the twist in his eye makes him look like he's trying to figure something out. I wait, but he never calls. I save the chocolates until they turn white.
Looking from a window above, it's like a story of love. Can you hear me? Came back only yesterday. I'm moving farther away. Won't you hear me? All I needed was...
One of my most prized possessions is a Patrick Scott gold painting. I bought it at a modern art auction at Adams of Dublin, almost unable to believe my luck when it was knocked down to me. I'd wanted one of the works of the master of Irish modernism for years, but never thought I'd be able to afford one. Although affording it was relative. I was in serious trouble with the bank manager afterwards. Coincidentally, I ran into Pat the following evening at the theatre. Still on a high, I went over to tell him, flinging my arms round him. "Which one?" he asked. "Gold painting number 6," I replied. Instantly, Pat said, "I painted that in 1966. This was about 20 years ago. As well as being a painter of groundbreaking genius, he'd a mind like a steel trap. He was also charming and gracious. I'm glad it's gone to a good home," he beamed. As of now, though, everyone can own their own Pat Scott for the princely sum of €3. To celebrate what would have been Patrick Scott's 100th birthday, On Post have issued a €3 stamp featuring 2 of his gold paintings, flanking an even larger one and incorporating the element he used in combination with his trademark gold leaf, pigment soaked straight into raw canvas. And the stamp is much larger than usual, making the artist's work and style vividly clear. Originally trained as an architect, Pat Scott felt his heart was not in the profession, although its influence remained with him as he refined his painting style, in the best sense of the word, throughout his life, influencing his elegant minimalism and fascination with clean shape. Most popularly, he's remembered for mischievously claiming that the livery he designed for CIE in the 1950s, stripes of black, white and orange, was inspired by the fur of his cat, Miss Mouse. That was the period when he collaborated with Cigna Design Consultants, which his friend and fellow artist Louis Labrocchi founded with the architect Michael Scott in the 1950s. Together, the three of them worked long and hard to improve the standard of design in Ireland, in which Patrick later said they hadn't been particularly successful. Never waspish, he said it in sorrow rather than anger. When he left architecture to paint full-time in 1960, in pursuit of that worthy aim, he also served on the board of the then newly formed Kilkenny Design Workshops. Patrick Scott was a founding member of Eas Thonaigh in 1981, the Association of Distinguished Irish Artists, and in 2007 was elected SEA. There can only be 8 SEA, the highest honour at any given time. And to date, only 20 artists in Ireland have been so honoured. The most recent was composer Roger Doyle. Labrocchi, of course, was also among them, having been elected in 1992. And that meant that there was another occasion I had to pinch myself when I realised I was living in a brief moment of artistic history. Louis and his wife, the equally distinguished painter Anne Madden, came to lunch, and on the same occasion, so did Patrick Scott. I suddenly realised that 2 SEA were at my table, along with another hugely acclaimed painter. This, I announced to the small gathering, is one of the great moments of my life, my SEA lunch. And if that sounds like boasting, it's because it is. Louis died in 2012 at the age of 95, much mourned. Patrick outlived him, dying in 2014. With perfect tragic timing, his death happened on February the 14th, St. Valentine's Day. Only a few months earlier, he had married his longtime beloved, Eric Pierce. A couple of weeks after his death, by coincidence, a long-planned major exhibition opened at IMA, the Irish Museum of Modern Art, Patrick Scott, Image, Space, Light. It celebrated the artist's extraordinary achievements in his long painting career. But Eric, who spoke at the opening, said only, "My heart is broken."
I was trawling through some vinyl last week when I came across the Harry Chapin album, Short Stories. One of the tracks on the album is a song called Mr. Tanner, the tale of a man who tried and, according to a critic, failed. I listened again to the song and it brought three things to mind. The first was a story I overheard when I was in my teens. The person who told the story had, in turn, overheard it told somewhere else. The original teller of the tale was an opera lover who had travelled from Ireland to a performance at La Scala. I don't, at this remove, remember the details, but the gist of the story was that the lead soprano, on the night, had failed to reach one or two of the higher notes, and the audience had erupted. Booing followed, and programmes had been thrown, and the unfortunate singer had left the stage in tears. Even as a young boy, the reaction of the audience struck me as not only unfair, but deeply unkind and cruel. The second was a regret that in 1978, when I had the chance to see Harry Chapin in concert at the RDS Library, funds were short, and the £3 admission fee was beyond me. I promised myself then that I'd definitely catch him the next time round. There was no next time. 3 years later, he had died following a road accident. He was 38 years old. But the third thing the album brought to mind is the true story behind the song Mr. Tanner. Years after its release, a man called Martin Tubridy began receiving phone calls and mails asking whether he was Mr. Tanner. Martin Tubridy had never heard of Mr. Tanner or the song of that name. He was not from Dayton, Ohio, as the character in the song is. And he dismissed the calls and mails. But still, they kept coming. Eventually, intrigued by the flood of people wanting to know about the life and music of the mysterious Mr. Tanner, he made some inquiries, heard the song, and realised it had been inspired by the reviews Harry Chapin had read of Martin Tubridy's concerts. The details of the story had been altered by the songwriter, but the heart of the tale remained the same. Martin Tubridy was a man who loved music and loved singing. He was a man with a rich baritone voice, and at the urging of his friends he had hired the New York Town Hall and the Carnegie Recital Hall in the early 1970s, got together musicians, sold tickets and put on concerts. The New York Times reviews were, to use his own word, devastating. Interviewed a couple of years ago, Martin Tubridy pointed out that Harry Chapin was himself no stranger to bad reviews, but never let that stop him writing and performing. What had attracted the songwriter to Martin Tubridy's story was the recognition of a fellow traveller. Chapin and Tubridy loved music and loved singing. They had both put themselves out there and exposed their abilities and vulnerabilities, inviting criticism and even derision at times. In the song, Mr. Tanner never sings in public again. In real life, Martin Tubridy changed musical direction and went on to entertain as a show singer. In 2016, Tom Chapin, brother of the late Harry, invited Martin Tubridy to join him on stage at a benefit for the Harry Chapin Charity Foundation. The song they sang that night was Mr. Tanner, and Martin Tubridy received a standing ovation for his beautiful and commanding performance. If ever a song recognised the power of a passion and the equally destructive potential of negativity, it's Mr. Tanner.
Mr. Tanner was a cleaner from a town in the Midwest, and of all the cleaning shops around, he'd made his the best. He also was a baritone who sang while hanging clothes. He practiced scales while pressing tails and sang at local shows.
Eggs. That same summer, she sent up the hills to Ahamore with a setting of eggs for Huey Johnny.
Walking slowly, eggs warm in her apron, she follows the old tracks across stile and footstick, thinks of her grandmother walking these same hills, defying her parents, learning Irish, marrying there. The buttercups are swathes of gold. She stops and stoops to pluck one, holds it to her chin till the sun spot hovers there, a sign she loves butter, and she does. Loves the red cows grazing and the splash of the churn, the bite of buttermilk on a day like this. She looks down over the lake, the road twisting in and out of sight, the world stilled in a hot haze. What will I do? What will become of me? She knows she could not bear to go to America, to leave all this. Time enough. Stop thinking. Today is all, and her dog is racing on, waiting, coming back to lick her hand away again, impatient and alert. She walks carefully, puts the flower in her apron pocket, breathes in the sweet, clean scent of meadows scythed and down, pauses on the shady lane near Granny Sally's, beneath a burst of fuchsia, pulls a gooseberry from the tangle of hedge, rubs it on her breast, bites the green, sour, tingled flesh and laughs. Thinks of the girl from the colliery in Arigna who walked here carrying a backload of fresh nettles from Corris to make soup. Sally fed her gruel on the doorstep of this house and the girl died when she got home. Her father, a stonemason, carved a rising sun on the side of a thin vertical stone to mark her grave. Somebody broke it later. The smell of manure riches the air. A cow is looing in the whitewashed byre. She touches the horseshoe over the door. The dog laps water from the old well, frog spawn deep and murky green. His pink tongue sends silver sparkles flying. Did Patrick rest here? Bless this well. A man-keeper basks on the hot mottled stone. If you were swift to catch him, lick his belly, you'd have a cure for burn. Now step across the stream and lift the woven willow hoop on the wooden gate, last slope to the great Scots pine. And standing under it, a man, a bush saw under his arm, not Hughie or his brother Jimmy, a young man, big-shouldered in a white shirt, long, strong face, stern, cap on his head. She pauses halfway up the field. The dog is walking on, tentative, tail wagging slowly now. He watches her, and something stirs within her. Some foretaste of what will be. Hello, he says, and smiles, warm as the day. Takes off his cap. Brown hair bounds up. Come on. I won't bite you. I'm John, Hughie's nephew. Who are you? Oh, I'm Mary Curley, and I'm come with a setting of eggs. He knew then and there he would marry her. Knew their children would run here.
On this morning's programme, we heard The Angel of Liberation by Conall Hamill, Sponge Cake and Culinary Ecumenism by Jodie Clark, After the Hymns by Lanny O'Hanlon, Patrick Scott, The Man Who Was Image, Space, Light was by Emer O'Kelly, Mr. Tanner, Martin Tuberty and Harry Chapin was by John McKenna, and the last piece, Eggs, a poem by Vincent Woods. The music was Mendelssohn's Elijah, For He Shall Give His Angels, sung by the choir of St. John's College, Cambridge. Sweets for My Sweet by The Drifters. Only You by Yazoo. Goldberg Variations, aria by Bach, played on piano by Glenn Gould. And Mr. Tanner by Harry Chapin. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Carolyn Dempsey and the producer is Sarah Binchy. And if you'd like to find out more about this and other arts and culture programmes, go to rte.ie/culture.
RTE Radio 1.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.